Patrick Lancaster is a photo and video journalist from the United States who has been covering the events in the eastern part of Ukraine for the last 4 months. Let's start with let's start at the beginning, which is something that they don't do in the media here in the United States very much. You know, there's been sort of a running narrative about what's happening in Ukraine, woven in and out of the headlines, depending on what else is going on, with some big gaps. And a serious bias to the narrative, of course, that begins and ends more or less with, we don't know what it is, but it's Putin's fault. The country is at civil war now. I think that's a fair assessment of the situation. You're on the ground, of course, and so if you disagree, please chime in on that. But assuming that, could you point to the genesis of this civil war, and over the not going back 100 years, but over the past year or so, and maybe bring us forward, like what's happened and how did we get where we are?
Well, I think some of the unrest in Donetsk really stemmed from after the replacements in the government in Kiev. One of the first things they went forward with was trying to make the Russian language not an official language anymore. And I think that really upset a lot of people. And of course, there was many different things that added to it, but it was kind of not the starting point, but something that got a lot of the people upset.
Why exactly did that upset people? I mean, I know symbolically it sounds, you know, like an offensive thing, you know, gee, they're picking on us or whatever. But what was the actual sort of gut response of people there based on? What was their thinking? Were they afraid? Were they upset? Was there, you know, what were they, why such a response?
Well, the vast majority of the people in this part of the country are ethnic Russians, and they speak Russian here. There's no people that really speak the Ukrainian language in this part of the country, and by Kiev making the Ukrainian language the only official language of the country, it just made people seem like they weren't really as part of the country as the Western part of the country.
Mm, right. Second-class citizens or something they were being sort of painted as or not as good as. So, all right, so it starts with this legislation after the coup, and that removes a law that had been installed a few years back that, you know, made Russian an official language. And then, you know, it's quite a long walk, though, from there to more or less open civil war. Maybe you could take us through, you know, some of the events on the touchstones from then to now.
Well, during April, I came from Crimea to Donetsk when I heard of the problem starting here. And my first day on the ground here in Donetsk, I visited the local administration building where they declared the Donetsk People's Republic. It was in the news quite a bit. I think most people are maybe familiar with the images of it.
Right.
But at that point, it was just basically that building in the city that had been under control of protesters. Mm. And there were no firearms visible at this point, just bats and sticks and clubs and things like this. Mm. You know, nothing super paramilitary. Mm. But on that same day, there was a meeting or a protest, and it happened to walk through Lenin Square, and more people started joining, and I think it got to the point where it was close to about 5,000 or so. Mm-hmm. And they walked straight to the local Donbass police station. Mm-hmm. And wasn't violent or anything at this point. It was just they were communicating with the police officers inside. From what was translated to me, how they were, you know, upset with the way the police department had been treating people, especially the members of the police department that were pro-Kiev. And then the protesters called the Berkut, which is a part of the paramilitary police service of Ukraine, and they came, and some people expected that they were going to try to, you know, kind of calm the people down. But at this point, they were like, you know, we're not going to fight the people. We're not going to stop you from doing this. You know, if you go ahead, you know, you go ahead. We refuse to fight the people.
Wow.
So we're leaving, is basically what they said. And they left. And then there was a few holes hitting on some glass of the police station, and then the doors came open, and riot police came out in full gear, and there was hours and hours of talking, but they eventually communicated that the police officers were going to let the protesters have the building.
Right.
And I was right there at the front, and when it was kind of like they were given permission to come in, but also kind of pushed in. It was a very kind of complicated situation. But once the first few people of the protesters came in, they put the little ribbons on all the riot police, the ribbons that signify the independence of Donetsk People's Republic, and let them all march out with these ribbons on them. Mm-hmm. And then A large part of the protesters went inside and took control of the building. And little things like that would happen around the city for the next couple of months.
This started when? This was April, was this?
Yeah, this was April.
Okay.
And from that point forward, you know, every week or every 2 weeks, you'd hear about a new building that was taken. And then, but they were all taken fairly peacefully. I mean, there was some violence, but, you know, no major,
like,
you know,
jostling, like
military strikes or anything take these buildings, just, you know, people going in.
Right.
But then I can't remember offhand the date, but the day that in Odessa, where so many people got burned alive inside the trade union building,
right.
That really kind of set off an interesting, well, I don't know how to put it exactly. It really set off a chain reaction of hostilities in response to those people losing their lives in such a horrible way. And that night, I went to the administration building, and there was a sort of funeral type memorial service going on where people were lighting candles for the dead of Odessa. But then I noticed at the same time there were car after car coming in, and people were going to the cars and unloading bags and boxes of ammunition and guns, just hundreds and maybe even thousands of weapons at that point. So I think, and then in the days after that and weeks after is when it really, in as far as Donetsk goes, really stepped up as far as the people being armed here. That's when it really turned into armed control of the government.
That was that incident in Odessa was May 2nd, was a Friday it began. Maybe you could just very quickly give people a summary of what happened there, because just so they understand what was going through people's heads in Donetsk after this incident.
What happened in Odessa?
Correct. Yeah.
Maybe you can give them overall.
There were radicals, pro-Kiev radicals. Odessa also has a sizable Russian-speaking population. It is also in the southeastern part of the country, and had a good number of people who were offended by the language law being repealed and other actions that were taken in Kiev. And some mobs grabbed some of those people, locked them, forced them back into the House of Trade Unions, and then burned it with the people inside, and dozens of people died in that incident. That was May 2nd. So that's just context. So that's what people were reacting to in Donetsk, this incident in Odessa. You there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So go ahead. Yeah.
In Donetsk, after that incident in Odessa, is when, you know, it started getting more real as far as the armed actions. And then over the next months, it got more and more organized, and it eventually just became to the fact that in reality the government in Donetsk is the Donetsk People's Republic government, because I mean every single government building in this area, mm-hmm. and city and region is controlled by the Donetsk People's Republic. There's no Ukrainian or Kiev organization running here. It's 100% the Donetsk People's Republic.
What's the sense among the people there? I mean, do they enjoy popular support, the Donetsk People's Republic, or are they, you know, a bunch of armed thugs that are repressing the local population that remains loyal to Kiev?
Well, you know, it's hard to say exactly, because the part of the population that is for the Donetsk People's Republic is very vocal about it. It is a large, very large part, I believe. But there are some parts of the population that aren't for the Donetsk People's Republic, and they are all quiet for the most part, unless you can talk to them behind closed doors. And, right. you know, they never want to be, you know, put on camera or recorded in any way, because they're scared. Right. And, I mean, it is... And it's because both sides in this conflict have done some very bad things to people. When I was in Kramatorsk at the beginning of July, you know, every day I'd go out and, for a week I was there, and every day there was bombings and mortars coming into the city day and night. And every day I'd go out and see more and more civilian buildings destroyed. It was really a horrible situation, because for 7 days of bombing, I only saw civilian buildings hit. I went all around the city, and I didn't see a single Donetsk People's Republic building hit by a mortar. It was only civilian houses, schools, wow. and orphanages. And apartment buildings.
And this is from the Ukrainian army or the National Guard?
Yes, the Ukrainian army.
Right. And they seem to be either they have really lousy targeting capability, or they're targeting civilians and not the government institutions.
Exactly. Yeah. It's in the areas that were hit, were some of them were around some of the Donetsk government buildings, but I can't say for sure. I'm not in the soldiers' minds, but if they're not targeting the civilians, they're putting forth a blatant disregard for civilian or non-combatant life.
Right. Gotcha. Because they're getting them, whether they intend to or not. They're not.
Yes. Not every day, new civilians were dying. New buildings were being hit. It was horrible. And now the same things starting to happen in Donetsk over the last week. Mm. And
yeah, I'm looking at the electoral map for the 2010 presidential election, and the region there had popular support for the Party of Regions, you know, for Yanukovych's party, for the, you know, I guess the pro-Russian, quote-unquote, party, About 70% of the vote was taken by Yanukovych in that area. So you have 30% that voted for Tymoshenko, which means you have 30% that are at least that are most likely sympathetic to Kiev, right? Is it a fair assessment?
Yes, that's.
So yeah, okay, that's normal.
That's before the evacuations have started. I think it's still probably a fair assumption.
Well, the evacuations are mostly of Russian speaking or people of Russian ancestry evacuating to Russia. Yes, or is there also a westward movement?
There's also Western movements. I have many people that I've met that have been trying to go to the European Union as refugees, or gotcha. Just more farther to the west in Ukraine.
Right. Wow. So if nothing else on the ground, it looks like the tendency is going to be towards more polarization, even if they work out a peace arrangement right now. On the ground, you're going to have less of a mixture across the country as people flee to the safe zones, they think. that's terrible. That's really bad news.
Yeah, it's a horrible situation here. And I think in the following weeks, it's going to get even worse. If the Ukrainian government handles Donetsk as they did Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and some of the other cities, it's thousands of civilians are going to die here. Wow. And it just doesn't seem like there's any easy way out of this conflict right now. I think there needs to be some sort of intervention between of some outside source to calm this situation down, because the way Kiev has been operating, it's just this slow hitting the towns and the cities a little bit every day, and just trying to wear the military, the Donetsk People's Republic forces down little by little, as they did in Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. It doesn't.
It's like a war of attrition.
So many civilians are going to die, right. And there has to be a different way to do this. Especially because when I was in Kramatorsk, I was there standing in Lenin Square when the Ukrainian army came in and raised a flag on the administration building in Kramatorsk, raised the Ukrainian flag, and then they left. It was a very surreal situation. No one knew exactly what to expect. They rolled in with tanks, and the Donetsk forces were already gone. They had evacuated the town. Mm-hmm. But the Ukraine rolled in with these tanks, raised the flag, and then just left the center and just disappeared. And then 2 hours later, there was another wave of mortars.
Oh.
It would come into the city. Just three mortars. It was very peculiar. It was like someone didn't get the message or something.
Jesus, that's bizarre. Is the situation on the ground fluid, or and I know it's changed too because of a ceasefire over the airplane incident. You know, let me ask about that.
What, ceasefire?
Yeah. I understand they couldn't get out, the inspectors couldn't get out for better than a week. I think they only got in finally Wednesday or Thursday because they were getting shot at, or the area was under attack from the Ukrainian army.
Well, I can definitely tell you there was no cease of fighting in the area of the Malaysian Airlines flight that went down. It was every day there was fighting in that proximity. I actually, last Sunday, I went up there, and well, I guess I should start from the beginning of the crash. I was actually, I got to the crash site about 3-4 hours after the plane came down. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, and I actually ended up staying there overnight, and there were by the next day, there were many journalists and Donetsk People's Republic soldiers. And within the following, as the days went by, just more journalists came, and there was, you know, hundreds of journalists, if not thousands. And but then I went back again this last Sunday, and it was a very weird scene, because it was completely deserted. No soldiers, no journalists. It was just me and my colleague were the only ones that were there. Mm. And as we tried to cover and document what we could, mm-hmm. Ukrainian jets started flying overhead and bombing Torez and Shakhtars, which are very close to the wreck site.
Right.
And then we realized that we were kind of in a interesting, dangerous situation.
Yeah, no kidding.
We were basically between the different towns that were where there were heavy clashes going on. Mm. And we had to try to figure out how to drive around those areas and kind of get close, but not too close, and get kind of out and away from the danger. But every little road that we went down, there were tank tracks, and the locals were telling us how we're seeing Ukrainian tanks and Donetsk forces tanks. Mm-hmm. And as we drove through the outskirts of Shakhtarsk, we were driving down the highway, driving into the sun, and there was a point when our taxi driver couldn't see in front of us a bit, and at that, because of the sun, the glare from the sun, that point, seven Donetsk People's Republic soldiers jumped out in front of us, or they were there and we just couldn't see them. I'm not sure exactly what happened because the sun was bright in our eyes. But they had Kalashnikovs held to us, and two of them had rocket-propelled grenades. I don't know exactly what they do with those in such close proximity, but it was kind of a scary situation, but we skidded to a stop with the Kalashnikovs to our heads, and once they realized that we were pressed, they were okay with us. They just said we need to go the other way.
Right.
And we picked up there was a woman crying on the side of the road, and we picked her up and took her out of the town to a safer town down the way. But it was definitely a very mind-opening day, because that day showed me how, you know, this war is really complicated and really horrible, because it's not just one side that's doing wrong. The Ukrainian government is, killing civilians on a daily basis, but also some parts of the Donetsk People's Republic forces are not doing the correct thing. We traveled through this small village, and there wasn't actually active fighting going on. As we looked in front of us in the center, we saw a group of vehicles and people, and as we got closer, we realized it was a platoon of Donetsk People's Republic soldiers. It was somewhere between 50 and 100, and there was two tanks, two large anti-aircraft guns, and it seemed that they were taking refuge in the very center of this small town.
Right.
And, I mean, my first thought of that was how very irresponsible that is, because there was so many towns around getting sieged by the Ukrainian army. Why would they be hiding in the middle of a populated area?
You know, I don't know about that, but on the other hand, I mean, with these, I understand that there's certainly some professionals involved and people that have either served in the Ukrainian military or what, the old Soviet military, even for some of the older people involved. But I'm thinking about if there were an analogous situation where I am in New York, outside New York City. That if for some reason suddenly, you know, the people had to arm themselves and fight the government, you know, I'd be scared of some of the characters that would be on my side, knowing them just as neighbors, okay? And, you know, suddenly they're armed with a Kalashnikov or whatever, and they didn't handle pruning shears very well without starting neighborhood wars and things like that. So it's not, I don't know if they would necessarily have the same military discipline among the troops there, you know, at the individual level and then at the platoon level, even, as you would expect from a professional military. So I don't know if the idea of war itself is immoral. So in terms of morality, it's already an even fight. But I don't know if I would hold a militia or a group, a military grouping in a revolutionary condition to the same standard as the professional military is supposed to be. Myself, that's just me. I don't know. I mean,
yes, but yeah. At the same time, there should be steps taken to reduce the possibility of non-combatant life being lost.
Yep, it's true.
I mean, I haven't seen the Donetsk People's Republic. I haven't seen this with my own eyes so many times, but there are times when they fire mortars from populated areas, and they have equipment in populated areas. So I think when they do that, that is, you know,
irresponsible,
frankly, irresponsible and against international law. Mm. But I mean, this is a very nasty war, and people, like you say, they kind of have to do what they have to do to survive. But it's just shows how much of a tricky situation this is.
I'm just saying, go back wherever you live, go back to your neighborhood, wherever you grew up, where you knew everybody. You know, if you had a place like that, and think about some of the people who, just because they live on the block, would be in your unit. And think about walking around with them armed with a gun or a mortar device or whatever, and how comfortable you'd be with some of them, you know. It's not a professional military situation. It's just a bunch of guys with weapons, which is scary. Anyway, so let me just be clear on something. So you were an eyewitness to the Ukrainian military bombing firing from fighter jets on the areas around the airplane crash site, where the inspectors were supposed to be able to have safe conduct and safe operations. Is that a true statement?
Okay. So I mean, there were jets flying overhead, and there were explosions happening in the towns. I was on an overlook, and I could see the jets flying, mm-hmm. and I could see huge plumes of smoke coming from three different villages, Torres, Shaktors, and a smaller village. And there were different jets flying, and there was much gunfire, and I could also hear anti-aircraft weaponry being fired.
So the characterization here in the media has been that the inspectors couldn't get to the site because of the Donetsk People's Republic units or irregulars or whatever. In other words, the rebels are preventing the inspectors from doing their job. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Right now, I think that's an inaccurate statement. I believe the fighting in the conflict was keeping them from getting to the crash sites as far as in the last days. The first 2 days of after the crash, there was some problems in the Donetsk People's Republic forces that were at the crash site, because I think they just weren't sure how to handle it when the OSCE observers showed up. Right. So for the first 2 days, there was some resistance by the Donetsk forces there as far as giving them proper access. But I was there the first day, the first time they were given the proper access on the Sunday after the accident, 3 days after the crash. And at that point, it seemed like the orders had made its way down the chain of command, and the OSCE forces were given very proper bodyguards. In my position, my opinion, the soldiers that were given to them seemed much more professional than the normal ones that had been at the crash site before. Right. They did a very strict made a very strict perimeter of the areas that the OSCE observers were inspecting at each given time. It seemed it was going very, very well for them getting access to the site. But in the following days after the fighting started, then that's when the lack of access happened to the crash site as far as the OSCE observers go. And that was because of the fighting near the crash site.
So now let's be clear about the facts on the ground. The crash site was in territory that was already in the control of the Donetsk People's Republic, correct?
Yes.
And so their fire would be defending the territory that they already hold, and the provocation would be an attempted invasion of that territory by the Ukrainian army, correct?
I believe the fighting occurred from the Ukrainian army coming into the area around the crash sites, and I have no way to say who fired first, The Ukrainian army came into that area that was not previously held by the Ukrainian army, that area of Ukraine, and then that's when the fighting erupted, when they moved to siege the different towns in that area.
Right. Okay. So because that fact isn't reported either. I mean, if you process the information that's spread out, because they accuse the Donetsk People's Republic forces of, tampering with the crime scene and all this stuff, then you understand that they're in control of the site. And then you understand that fighting is offense, Ukrainian army, defense, Donetsk People's Republic, because they hold the territory. But they don't put that together. Instead, somehow the fighting and the denial of access is still the fault of the Donetsk People's Republic, rather than a failure on the part of the parties to say, okay, look, we're all going to keep the territory that we hold right now. No one's going to redeploy forces or fight or attempt to recover territory from either side. These guys can come in, do their work. Anybody who needs to come in has safe escort in and out, does their work, and then leaves. And then we go back to fighting. That I guess that's the basis of the agreement that was supposed to take place, and maybe it is now. Is it quiet now?
I have not been to the crash sites in the last few days, so I can't really speculate on that. I was.
Maybe you could tell us about where you were the past few days.
Well, day before yesterday, I was in Slavyansk trying to cover some investigate some reports of some mass graves that were supposedly found. But on the way back from Slavyansk, I was on a bus, and we were traveling through Kramatorsk, and we made it to the south side of Kramatorsk, where there's a Ukrainian army checkpoint. And at that point, the bus stopped, and the soldiers who were wearing the Berkut insignias and the Ukrainian flag was flying there because it was well in the Ukrainian territory. Mm-hmm. They had all the men get off the bus, and they checked all the documents. They checked our documents, and we showed them our passports and the only press credentials we actually had at the time were the Donetsk People's Republic press passes that are given by the local administration building here in Donetsk, by the press center. And eventually we had to show them that. But the soldiers seemed unsure what to do with us because, just because they didn't know. But then they told us, wait. They kept the bus waiting. They said someone will come soon. And then three masked soldiers that seemed to be a little bit more high-ranking came over and took our documents and then told us we had to wait longer. But finally, after about 2 hours of us waiting there, they sent our bus on. And they had our bus just leave us there, and they told us we could not take our bus. We had to stay and wait for the security service, they called it. And then two men came and introduced themselves as members of the SBU. And then they looked at our documents, asked us many questions, and then informed us that we were going to be detained overnight. So they took us into the Kramatorsk, and they held us in a, it wasn't really a hotel or an apartment building. It was it was this big building with many different rooms, with like old Soviet style apartments where there was the different rooms and shared bathrooms. I'm not sure exactly what the function of the building was.
Like a youth hostel maybe or something.
What's that?
Like a youth hostel maybe or something.
It was, it seemed a little bit like that, only a little bit non-commercial. I don't know if it was actually a government building, like housing facility or what it was. But they kept us there overnight, they said, in order to check our documents. I don't know exactly what they were checking. And they were a bit upset that we weren't in the Kiev authorized journalist database. And it's actually kind of difficult for freelancers to get on that database, especially if you don't publish, you know, totally pro-Ukrainian material.
Hey, let me let me just interrupt you for a second and ask you, were you, among the documents you were you carrying your American passport?
Yes, they took my American passport.
And the, your colleague that was detained, what nationality and what document?
Well, there was two other colleagues detained. One was American. He had an American passport. And the other was British, and he used his British passport.
Okay. So if they were going to check, one place they could check is with the embassies, I guess, right?
We actually were able to contact our embassies that evening. As far as the American embassy, they actually, kind of surprisingly, really helped a lot. The first night they you know, they got all our information if there was anybody we needed they needed to contact, and then by that next morning we were actually able to they were able to get in touch with the SBU and the people that were detaining us, and they seemed to communicate some sort of arrangement where we would be released. And finally, the SBU members came back in the morning and told us that they had checked our passports, but we can go, but they strongly recommend we don't go to go to Donetsk. They recommended that we go more to the north and west. so
these are big scary soldier guys with guns and stuff, right? That are making the suggestion.
No, actually, at this point, these were the more...
It's like the FBI
the
guys.
Administrator. Yeah, they were something like the Secret Service. All in civilian uniforms, or civilian clothes.
Lots of sunglasses and earpieces and stuff.
a little bit more...
a little more subtle.
Not professional, actually.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
They recommended that they strongly recommended that we do not go to Donetsk, but we told them we understand the recommendation, but if we're free to do what we want, we wish to return to Donetsk to cover what we can there.
So what's going on there now? What's the mood like in Donetsk? What are people doing? What's the daily day-to-day like? And maybe you could describe that for our listeners.
Well, the day-to-day activity is every night we hear gunfire and explosions in the distance. I'm actually staying fairly close to the center, but every day we hear explosions coming from the area of the train station or the area of the airport. It's kind of the common thing that there are explosions. I mean, every few days, there's a civilian home blown up or burned down by the Ukrainian army fire. Every week, for the last 2 weeks, at least once, one day during the week, there has been hundreds of civilians trapped at the air, at the train station because of the shelling around the train station, and they've had to be evacuated by city bus. Yeah, that's the day-to-day activities. People are still walking around the streets. I mean, not as much as normal, but there's still life in Donetsk. I'd say maybe 50 to 70% of the businesses are closed most days.
Patrick, thank you very much, brother. Take care, man. Be safe. All right. Okay, bye.
Thank you, Don.
Bye-bye.